It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
For all the coverage of the dastardly virus, there is one group that has been all but ignored. I'm talking about dogs. What about the dogs? Listen to this lead.
Look at that face, those pleading eyes, that nose that kept you company all through the pandemic. Now explain to Cooper, Cooper's a doggy, why it is so, so important that you return to the office, leaving her alone all day after 2 years of 24/7 togetherness. This is unusually good writing in the New York Times. They go out and interview a bunch of people. Todd McCormick, a derivatives trader on Manhattan's Upper West Side, says, I don't believe I'll ever go back to the office as his dog Higgins demanded a cracker. Many New Yorkers have returned to their workplaces and never stopped going, but for those contemplating the transition now and for their dogs, a day of reckoning has arrived. Now, this is interesting. More than 23 million American households during the pandemic added a cat or a dog during this period. Not much about cats in here. Cats always get short shrift. Anyway, they photobombed Zoom meetings, typed cryptic messages on their humans' laptops, and found other ways to contribute to the interspecies work environment. For many people, their dogs were the only warm body around. Therapist, companion, and entertainment system rolled into one. Now their employers want them to give it up. And this is a quote from a woman who runs training for the Manhattan School of Dogs, says, we've had a lot of separation cases coming through. So anybody know a good dog therapist? Your Elon episode for today, the guy who is in the process of kind of sort of trying to buy Twitter, is being attacked as some far-right Trump-loving lunatic, even though he voted for Barack Obama. He's given a whole bunch of money to the ACLU. He cares about the environment. That's why he started an electric car company. But now, Musk giving some fodder to people who says, oh, he's just become this right-wing Republican, posting the following. The reality is that Twitter at this point, you know, has a very far-left bias. I would classify myself as a moderate, neither Republican nor Democrat. And here it comes. So Musk saying on a podcast, I voted overwhelmingly for Democrats historically. Like, I'm not sure. I might never have voted for a Republican. Now this election, I will. Aha. And then he tweeted, in the past, I voted Democrat because they were mostly the kindness party. But they have become the party of division and hate. So I can no longer support them and will vote Republican. Now, watch their dirty tricks campaign against me unfold. I don't know if there'll be dirty tricks or not, but I do think there'll be a lot of backlash because he seems to be announcing, hey, I don't even know if I've ever voted Republican, but I've changed. I've been radicalized. I don't like where the Democratic Party is going. Well, lots of people say that. Lots of people are also disaffected by where the Republican Party in the age of ultra-MAGA has gone. But when you're Elon Musk, world's richest man, and you're trying to buy Twitter for $44 billion, it has an impact. Twitter, meanwhile, is saying it tends to enforce the agreement with Musk to buy the company. I'm sure there'll probably be some price reduction given what's happened to the stock and the stock market as a whole. But the thing is, Twitter realizes that if Musk does somehow walk away, even if he has to pay this $1 billion breakup fee, where does that leave Twitter? A lot of its top executives are leaving or have been fired. Its reputation has been in the harsh media spotlight. And at the same time, nobody else wants to buy it. So we'll see. All right. Story number one, disinformation. You remember the government's Disinformation Governance Board? It's been around since 3 weeks ago. Well, it looks like it's toast. It was a really, really, really bad idea, made much worse by the complete botched rollout. First of all, the dystopian name, Disinformation Governance Board. What are they going to govern?
it really became, fairly or unfairly, a symbol of federal censorship and intimidation. Well, now, in Washington speak, it's been put on pause, which is the Beltway bureaucracy's way of saying, you know, we want to shelve this thing that's killing us. Hope everyone forgets about it so we can quietly knock it off. 3 weeks it lasted. Now, it didn't help, in my view, that the director of this board, Nina Jankowicz, has a long history of liberal advocacy, from ripping Elon Musk's Twitter takeover bid to dismissing the Hunter Biden laptop story back in 2020 as a Russian influence op and fairy tale. But more fundamentally, who needs federal government officials defining what disinformation is anyway? The Washington Post broke the story. DHS decided to shut down the board, according to multiple people. By Tuesday, Jankowicz had drafted a resignation letter in response to the board's disillusion. Then there was this sort of urgent phone call. She was given the choice to stay on. It's not clear where they stand, where that stands, whether she'll stay on for an interim period, whether there'll even be a board for her to come back to, or whether she's going to, you know, clean out her desk. Now, you know, part of the blame here lies with Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, who admits he just handled it badly, came out, couldn't really explain what it was supposed to do. We're gathering best practices. But it sounded like, you know, it was going to contact social media companies if it thought that something that they were saying was untrue. It just wasn't clear. Now, at the same time, Jankowicz, who had been told not to speak by DHS, went to Facebook and said she'd been barraged with sexual taunts, death threats, been described as a conniving, ugly, pregnant, fascist, treasonous Jewish woman. Now, I don't wish that on anybody, but it does raise an interesting question. But before I even go any further, this idea, listen to this headline in the Washington Post that broke the story by Taylor Lorenz: how the Biden administration let right-wing attacks derail its disinformation efforts. And it's totally pro-disinformation board, totally pro-Jankowicz. And in fact, it kind of matches the line that the Biden administration is putting out. And I would just say this. Is there any other case where the Biden administration has just caved to conservative criticism and decided to get rid of some agency or even fire somebody? The fact is, this thing was indefensible. They now say, oh, we wanted to get information just to migrants to combat the lies and protect national security. But the whole thing is just fuzzy. If it doesn't have any power or authority, why was it marketed as if it did? So I have to say, I know Taylor Lorenz is very controversial. Some people think she's a good reporter, or people love beating up on her. But this story is totally slanted. She says in the piece that Jankowicz has been subject to an unrelenting barrage of harassment and abuse, while unchecked misrepresentations of her work continue to go viral. And this is, cue the scary music, a prime example of how the right-wing internet apparatus operates. Now, just by coincidence, I'm sure, DHS spokesperson saying Nina Jankowicz has been subjected to an unjustified and vile personal attacks and physical threats. In congressional hearings and in media interviews, the secretary has repeatedly defended her as eminently qualified, and underscored the importance of her department's disinformation work. Here's the thing. This is actually an important point that goes well beyond this case. Just about anybody, if you're on TV, if you have a column, even if you're just Joe or Josine Blow, and you're on Twitter and you say stuff, you get slimed. You can get slimed. And it's particularly worse for women, no question about it, because in all the misogyny and all the sexual mockery and so forth comes in. So I'm not defending that. I think it's one of the things that makes Twitter in particular, and it happens on other social media too, kind of a sewer. And a lot of people have gotten off, or the more prominent people, because they don't want to, you know, because life is short and they want to put up with this crap. Now, Taylor Lorenz knows that because she gave a tearful interview to MSNBC that the vicious online attacks against her made her contemplate suicide. But at the same time, Taylor Lorenz has been criticized for outing, we talked about this on the podcast some weeks ago, the previously anonymous woman who runs Libs of TikTok, saying she was, and this was in the headline of that Washington Post piece, secretly fueling the rights outrage machine. And that brought a lot of online abuse against this woman, and I'm not going to name her, the former Brooklyn real estate agent. So I asked this question. It's all right to criticize a private citizen who didn't want her identity known, but not a federal government official with actual authority. So in other words, if you're sympathetic to the person, you say, oh my God, this person's gotten all these death threats and abuse and been called all kinds of terrible names, and it's the fault of the person who wrote this piece, A, B, C, D, E piece. But unless it is a lie, you know, it would seem to exempt anybody from criticism because they're going to get abuse on Twitter. In other words, I'm sure when Taylor Lorenz writes a piece, when I write a piece, when anybody writes a piece or goes on Twitter and voices an opinion, we're not intending to unleash a campaign of vilification against that person. It happens because Twitter has a mob mentality and it's hyperpartisan and everybody enjoys piling on. Everybody then retweets the piling on. You can't necessarily blame journalists, commentators, activists, bloviators for the online abuse that follows. Online abuse is a fact of life. Now, I like this piece in National Review because it kind of agrees with me. A better editor would have looked at Taylor Lorenz's story and said, no, that's not the story. Keep digging until you find an explanation that makes sense, checks out, and is less self-serving to those involved. The piece asserts that within the small community of disinformation researchers, her work was well regarded. I'm not disputing that. The National Review author says, well, yeah, what about when she sang that parody version of a Mary Poppins song? But okay, she's entitled to sing. As much as I would love to believe that conservative voices on the internet have awesome and far-reaching power that makes cabinet secretaries quake in their boots, that is not the way the world has ever worked. That is not the way the world works now. And that is not the way the world will likely ever work. Federal agencies don't shut down projects just because they're getting a lot of critical coverage in the media, particularly conservative media. If that were true, if intense criticism from the net could get a federal official to resign, then Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Anthony Blinken, Alejandro Mayorkas, Merrick Garland, Janet Yellen, and just about the entire Biden administration would all be cleaning out their desks.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner, for a look at how we can advocate for a cleaner earth while strengthening U.S. energy independence. Available now on foxnewspodcast.com.
All right, story number two, continuing fallout from the mass shooting in Buffalo. As the New York Post reports it, New York Governor Kathy Hochul, who obviously succeeded Andrew Cuomo and is up for re-election in November, is pushing executive orders and legislation to combat gun crimes and domestic terrorism. That includes an executive order that will require state police to seize weapons under the state's red flag law from potentially dangerous people whenever they have probable cause to believe an individual is a threat to themselves or others. Probable cause is a legal term, and it's kind of murky. I mean, remember, New York is one of the states that has this red flag law. The alleged shooter was, in fact, taken into custody by police as a high school senior last year and underwent a psychiatric evaluation and then was let go. How do you determine probable cause? I mean, should more have been done in retrospect? Yeah. Hochul is also targeting online extremism by ordering state police to dedicate a unit to monitoring social media for potential threats by extremists. That makes sense, I guess. Everyone should probably already be doing that. And then she gets to the gun control part. There's a bill that would require that semi-automatic handguns made or sold in New York include features that would mark ammunition with a micro stamp after it is fired. And that's to help investigators later on. So, look, if this happens in your state and you're the Democratic governor, you want to show that you're doing something. And I'm not necessarily taking issue with most of the specific steps, but there is a certain quality of, you know, locking the barn door after the horse has gotten out. It's only after the tragedies, this is true in a lot of realms of life, that's like, oh, we should do more of this. We should create a unit to do that because the system failed. I don't know if the system could have got this guy. I don't think the system can catch every nutty, mentally ill person who then legally buys a semi-automatic rifle. I don't know. I do hope that we can catch more of them because I'm getting awfully tired, like everybody else, of hearing about these absolutely tragic cases, and I'm glad that many media outlets have put the focus on the 10 victims, mostly black victims in a supermarket in Buffalo who were just going to buy some food. It's just, this one is tough to deal with. Okay, so the other day I quoted National Review talking about the fact that there's a legitimate debate in this country and by Republicans and conservatives about the policy of letting in lots of immigrants or allowing them to sneak their way illegally into this country and what effect that has on politics. So just to balance a little bit here is a piece in The Atlantic. Starts out by quoting some conservative pundits. It actually makes a reference to the piece by Rich Lowry, who says it's true. Democrats want higher levels of immigration to change national elections. There are two versions of the replacement conspiracy theory, says Atlantic, but both of them share the same basic premise. The first is that a secret cabal, typically composed of Jews, is fostering democratic change in the U.S. through immigration in order to replace its white population. That was the motive of mass murders in Pittsburgh, El Paso, and now Buffalo. The second is that liberals are fostering democratic change in the U.S. through immigration in order to replace its white population. Both conceive of America as fundamentally white and Christian, and in doing so posit that not only a racial conception of citizenship, but a racial hierarchy. The conspiracy theory has grown so popular among key Republican figures that the conservative elite can no longer condemn it without reservation because they don't want to alienate their base. I mean, here's a quote from one of the House leaders, Elise Stefanik of New York, in an ad from last year, wants to overthrow our current electorate and create a permanent liberal majority in Washington. Goes on to say that liberals can do nothing to prevent conservatives from embracing this conspiracy theory beyond forcing Republicans to pay a price at the ballot box. All right, let's move on to number three. Speaking of fallout from certain midterm elections, and particularly Pennsylvania. So now that there's going to be a recount in that Senate race between Dr. Oz and McCormick, a lot of attention is now focused, big pieces in the big papers, to the Republican who won the nomination for governor of the Keystone State, Doug Mastriano. Here's the Washington Post story. As a Pennsylvania state senator and gubernatorial candidate, Doug Mastriano railed against the rampant fraud that he believes was responsible for Donald Trump's 2020 defeat. He vowed to decertify voting machines in counties where he suspects the result were rigged. And he asserted that the Republican-controlled legislature should have the right to take control of the all-important choice over which presidential electors to send to Washington. As governor, Mastriano would have the opportunity to act on this. This is a guy who was endorsed by Trump, you know, kind of at the last minute because he was going to win anyway. He would gain significant influence over the process in that key battleground state in 2024. Now, this is not some revelation or secret. Mastriano talks about this quite openly. In Pennsylvania, the governor has what's kind of the unusual authority to directly appoint the Secretary of State, who serves as the chief election officer. And Mastriano says he's already got somebody in mind, telling Steve Bannon's podcast, I have a voting reform-minded individual who's been traveling the nation and knows voting reform extremely well. It's going to be a top issue for me. Now, here's the thing. Part of the effort to overturn the Electoral College victory of Joe Biden was to let state legislators, partisan actors in Republican-controlled legislatures, make the decision. So, you know, if Mastriano was elected and able to do this, it would take it out of the hands of some neutral department, you know, Department of Elections or Department of State, and allow, you know, what's to stop, if the Republicans have a majority in the legislature, them from saying, well, you know, we don't agree. We think the votes were fraudulent, and we are sending Trump electors. So that's why the Democrats are kind of freaking out. Trump had grown annoyed with Mastriano, two former advisors said, because he was unable to gain traction in helping him overturn the election, but now they stay in touch. Well, here's the New York Times version. Republican voters' choice of Doug Mastriano in the governor's race is giving the GOP fits. Conversations with Republican strategists, donors, lobbyists reveal a party seething with anxiety, dissension, and score settling over Mastriano's nomination. Some are using phrases like suicide mission, disaster, and voyage of the Titanic to convey just what a catastrophe they believe his candidacy will be for the party. They're basically saying he can't win a general election. Meanwhile, Donald Trump gave Dr. Oz, who he endorsed, some advice. Dr. Oz should just declare victory. Remember, there's an automatic recount that has to be done. It just makes it much harder for them to cheat with the ballots that they just happened to find, Trump said on Truth Social. Okay. Story number four. Coming back to COVID, this will be the focus on humans, not the doggies. Federal health officials warning yesterday, this is the CDC, a third of Americans live in areas where the threat of COVID-19 is now so high, they should consider wearing a mask in indoor public settings. Rochelle Walensky says the seven-day average of hospital admissions from COVID rose 19% over the previous week, about 3,000 people a day being admitted with COVID, although death rates remain low. And the number of new cases is about 103,000 a day now. So, according to the CDC, more than 32% of Americans now live in counties with medium to high risk levels of virus transmission, compared to 24% the previous week. So Walensky is saying, not requiring, but saying, that if you live in such an area, you should consider things like masking in indoor public settings and more frequent testing. But, as the New York Times points out, this is at odds with President Biden's stance. The CDC and the White House just often don't see eye to eye on this at all. The attitude in the West Wing more closely mirrors that of most Americans, who have eagerly moved away from mask wearing and other strategies to prevent infection. In fact, you know, while Biden is dealing with Ukraine and he's dealing with inflation and he's dealing with baby formula, he's not talking much about COVID. He's tried to move on, but people keep getting it. For example, it was announced yesterday that HHS Secretary Javier Becerra tested positive. So did Ashley Biden, the president's daughter. She was going to accompany him on this trip to Asia, but she had to drop out because of the positive tests. Biden says that the change in his tone is a result of success. Many people are vaccinated, a fair number have been boosted, and those new doses plus new antiviral treatments have been warding off serious disease. But, you know, it's also political reality. Obviously, this is where most of the country is. You know, you want to wear a mask? Great. Be my guest. Many Americans have decided to accept the risk of infection to resume their normal routines. But that, in turn, is making it hard for Biden to get his $22 billion request, or even $10 billion, which I think the Republicans are offering, in to replenish the supply of COVID tests, COVID treatments, COVID vaccines before the fall, when another, perhaps even larger wave is anticipated. The administration wants to launch a new booster campaign in the fall. Now, that had been tied up with the Ukraine military aid bill, but Congress split it in two, and it's going to pass the Senate after this week-long delay caused by Rand Paul, who just wanted to delay it because he doesn't agree with it. And we'll see. I mean, if it's the new normal, look, I mean, they're not going to fall into the same trap of mandating again and again and again, people have to wear a mask. And that's about where the country is. You know, offer the guidance if you want, Rochelle Walensky. People are going to make up their own minds. And a lot of governors and mayors feel burned
because they went through the whole masking thing, and then it turns out a lot of people got COVID anyway. But, you know, keep in mind, if you are vaccinated, if you are boosted, you are very, very, very likely to get a much milder version of it. Obviously, it hits different people differently and stay out of the hospital, and that is a very good thing and a far cry from where we were in 2020.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
And let's wrap up with story number five. President Biden invoking the Defense Production Act yesterday to address this nationwide shortage of baby formula. This is a law that was passed during the Korean War to ramp up domestic manufacturing and is very, very rarely used, at least on this scale. So the White House is saying that the suppliers of key formula ingredients will have to prioritize the delivery of those resources to the companies, there are only four American companies, including Abbott, that produce formula. And they're going to use Defense Department cargo to fly it to wherever it needs to be. That's great. This is a crisis. It's an absolute freaking crisis. Why the delay? Why not invoke the Defense Production Act last week? Why, in fact, not devote the Defense Production Act or bring it into use a month ago when there were all kinds of warnings because of that Abbott laboratory that was shut down in February due to signs of contamination? And here we get to early May and it's still not reopened. Yes, the Justice Department just signed a consent decree and it'll probably reopen in about 2 weeks, but that still means production will be 6 to 8 weeks away. Why is the government playing catch up on this? You know, I saw a headline or a tweet by somebody saying, if men had to breastfeed, there would be no baby formula shortage. And, you know, it was meant to be sort of semi-funny, but I kind of think it's true. But, you know, that's not to say that only mothers are worried about this. Dads, moms, grandmothers, grandfathers, everybody's worried about this shortage. And putting out this stuff about, oh, here's a website you can go to maybe find a formula, you know, several hours away, but you have to go drive. It just, I'm glad the president did this. I know government moves slowly, but this is as much of a crisis as anything else we faced. If you've got a two-month-old who can only have formula for whatever reason you can or choose not to breastfeed, and you go to all the stores and you're checking with people and you can't find formula, particularly a specialty formula that certain babies need, it's just unbelievable in my view. So the House, meanwhile, approved a bill that would expand access to formula for low-income Americans. And then the Democrats adopted $28 million in new FDA funding, hoping to prevent future disruptions and enhance safety inspections. I think we're going to find out a lot more about that Abbott plant in Michigan and the sanitation concerns and so forth. I mean, Biden is right when he says we've got to do this as quickly as possible. And at the same time, you know, this is stuff we're putting into the mouths of babies. We've got to make sure it's safe. But, you know, this is the most basic responsibility of government. It's why we have an FDA. It's why we have agencies devoted to making sure that the food supply is safe, not to mention that the skies are safe to fly or that our minds are safe. You name it, environmental agencies. And then inevitably, when there's some crisis like this one, this is a rare one in that it touches, you know, millions and millions of families, whereas not to minimize it, but, you know, if there's a mine collapse or some sort of natural disaster, some sort of hurricane, where it turns out, you know, the buildings weren't up to code and therefore they collapsed. It affects one set of people in a local area. This affects everybody in America. And by the way, why do we have these stupid rules against importing baby formula based on things like minor labeling disputes? It's to protect the profits of these four American companies. We can't even, not even allowed to get it from Canada. It's just insane. It's why people think government doesn't work. And unfortunately for Biden, who I can't say has done a terrific job on this, I mean, again, glad the president did this. Would have been better if he had done it
weeks ago. And by the way, the media fell down too, and I've talked about this. Everybody reported, a lot of news organizations reported on the Abbott plant shutdown in February. And then there were these pair of reports in mid-April in the Washington Post and Wall Street Journal saying Target, Walmart, and other major retailers were rationing baby formula because of a shortage. The entire media establishment should have jumped on that the next day, but not until the administration said, well, the FDA is a 10-point plan, did it become a major media controversy. It's not like the moms didn't know about this. It just is exasperating. It's not the way the system is supposed to work. And I'm going to stay critical. And I criticized President Trump. I criticized President Obama. I criticized President Bush when I thought the government wasn't doing the job. And, you know, it's your tax dollars at work. You have a right to think that the government can act swiftly and avoid something like this. It's a totally avoidable crisis. It's not like we don't know how to make baby formula. It's just a distribution problem. It's an importation problem. And it's a government bureaucracy moving too slowly problem. And that's why I'm all worked up about it. Hey, appreciate your sharing some time with me. It would be great if you would subscribe. Remember those dogs and cats. Back here tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.